Now, every week I think to myself, can it get any crazier in our national world conversations than last week? And by golly, it can. I'm something of a fake news junkie. And by that I mean I get my news from the likes of CNN, and each night I watch the NBC Evening News with Lester Holt. I was so happy when Lester got that job. Lester was in Chicago for all the years that I was there, and he has always been one of the most humbly strong, intelligent, good communicators, and I celebrated his transition to that national news desk. And this week was so busy with significant news stories that they nearly had to expand the half-hour time slot. And then NBC always ends with a feel-good, inspirational story, and I have come to dread it. As much as anything, I think, because of their trite methodology, that does not mean that they should not be putting good news, good uplifting news stories, and maybe, but I'd rather that they fit it in naturally rather than just forcing them in at the end. And then to my sensibilities, they failed to hit the best good news story of the week. I posted about it on my Facebook page, and several of you saw it. J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter series, has spent her way off the list of the world's billionaires. She spent her way off the list by giving her money to charities. She said, and I quote, "You have a moral responsibility when you have been given far more than you need to do wise things with it and to give it away intelligently," end quote. What a great counterbalance to what we're going through. Last Sunday in our announcements, we used one of our large screen smart televisions to project off of my Facebook page a picture of one of our church's young men who had gone missing. He was a runaway, and he was found, incidentally, later last Sunday afternoon. And that page was copied a minimum of 231 times and was immediately, you know, seen throughout the Bloomington area, leading to a huge awareness of his dilemma. Now, I do not know if these two are connected, but I saw in the obituaries earlier in the week that a 13-year-old from his school had committed suicide the day before. It's a small school, and I cannot help but find the two connected. You know, the trans community of which ACE is a part, these folks who are or who have transitioned from being male or female to the other gender expression, in that relatively small community in our country alone, they have seen 19 of their friends openly murdered already this year. Murdered by straight people. Can you imagine living with the anxiety of being so at risk all the time? The suicide rate for those in the trans community, of course, is staggeringly high. And I want to thank all of you for being personally and as a faith community a safe place for those in so many at-risk populations. Most places in our country are still not safe. I flew the gay flag, you know, out on the signboard this last week, and it was again ripped to shreds, thrown away in the trash. As close as the space out there between us and the sidewalk is not safe. Talk with your friends and associates about how tragic it is that for most of our society, it is so unsafe for those who are different than the dominant and privileged sexual and racial and religious expressions. Find a way to talk about it, because only by gently and by being well-informed to the dangers, while bringing it up as a member of the privileged groups, can others less privileged be made safe. Just safe. It's an imperative of our faith that we look after those less privileged than ourselves. Every one of us has someone who needs that which we can intelligently give away. Privilege is a sin. When not consistently and always being used to benefit the well-being of others. Just saying. In the world in the time of Jesus, the divisions in his society were every bit as great and ugly as ours. Racially, sexually, ethnically, culturally, nationally. And the divisions between the haves and the have-nots were perhaps even more glaringly apparent, as 90% of the people in ancient Judea were poor. Poor to the point of near starvation, while the upper and rich 10% were unbelievably wealthy. I read this past week that a staggeringly high percentage of our population is at the borderline of being food insecure. Not sure where their next meal is coming from. It's not that food isn't available, they don't know how they're going to get it. Many, if probably most, are employed, but the cost of living is so high that a majority of their incomes go to other expenses, you know, like rent, medical, and transportation cost, that most of them suffer in the area of basic food and nutrition. We have a scripture story that I hope you noticed some familiarity as I read it, and you heard Jesus calling a non-Jewish woman a dog. I understand that black women have not forgotten our President Trump calling a former senior advisor of his, Omarosa, a dog just a couple weeks ago. In context, ancient Judeans did not see dogs as cute little house pets, as service animals to support us, but more as dirty scavengers, like we might see coyotes today. You didn't want dogs around, and when possible, you kicked them and you beat them with sticks and stones. When you wanted to scapegoat someone, to call them a dog then as today was far too common. Now, we've been in the Gospel according to Mark for a few weeks now, and we pay attention, I pay attention at least, to a verse or two at a time. But the book was written with what? General thematic purpose and direction. If we had been reading whole sections of it, you would have already seen more readily what I'm about to tell you. The focus for Mark in these last two chapters that we've been spending a lot of time on has been about feeding the hungry. And whoever wrote Mark's gospel moves us from the mass feeding of 5,000 Jews to smaller and smaller metaphoric feedings of the hungry and those in need in very individual situations, but always with Jews, okay? And Jesus was a Jewish rabbi after all, but this morning, like with a movie camera, the author begins to refocus the lens and begins to pull back from the Jewish focus and gives us a broader look at the world that surrounds Jesus. This morning, Jesus has left Judea and has traveled to the area of two coastal cities so that he can get away from the crowds who have been following him. He wants to rest, the text says, but his fame is so far and wide, and though Jesus has interacted with Gentiles before in Mark, this week's story is a decisive plot point in this larger narrative of scandalous, widening inclusion. Tyre and Sidon. They're kind of coastal cities in the Roman province of, not Judea, but of Syria to the north, okay? As well as they were historic centers of the Phoenician naval empire, an ancient nemesis of Israel. Thus, for Mark's audience, as they're hearing this, these cities simultaneously evoke not just foreign, but also hostile, people we don't really like. A Syro-Phoenician woman, Syria and Phoenician combined, desperate because your young daughter is possessed by an unclean spirit, hears about where Jesus is, and she comes to see him. But please note, in that story, she does not, can I come in? She does not wait, and she pleads and does not plead her case even from out on the street. She enters the house, just burst in. She throws herself at Jesus' feet. Her sheer audacity, reminiscent, I think, of the audacity of that woman with a hemorrhage, is nothing short of scandalous in that first century context. and perhaps in ours today, if it happened at your house. She is neither kin to Jesus or even known to him. She enters a house and she boldly makes her plea. What's more, she traverses barriers set not only by patriarchy and other cultural norms, but also by religion, ethnicity, and the long-standing enmity between peoples. She is a Gentile. He is a Jew. Jesus' initial reaction is keeping, incidentally, recognizing those old barriers, and says, "Let the children," that is the children of Israel, "be fed first, for it is not fair." It's just not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Got him calling her a dog. Now, the late Reverend Dr. Fred Craddock was a master of preaching a text like this when there's so many different ways to look at it. And he would say something like this: "Now, wait a minute. What is Jesus up to here? What is this, at least, what is this story up to here? Is he pronouncing an age-old prejudice, like a slow-pitch softball floating over home plate precisely so this gifted, fierce young mother can take her bat and knock it out of the park? Maybe. Or is he bogged down in what his teachers taught him, as we so often are? Does Jesus learn something from the woman in this back and forth that happens? Does she change his mind? Is she the rabbi here? The one who will open his perspective just a bit more? A bit more." You know, later on, he says to the man in Sidon, a story that I didn't say, he says to the guy who is both, who has no hearing and who cannot speak, he says, "Be opened." But could it be that he only does so because this woman has already done the same for Jesus and helped him be more open? Perhaps. Or is there a twinkle in Jesus' eye, even from the outset? Does he know very well that God's geometry cannot and will not be contained to one small circle only, but finally must become a great circle that includes every other circle? Does he in fact know this perfectly well, but takes more pleasure in her making the point, as only she can, rather than making it himself? He makes so many points, after all. Why not open the space so this woman can make one? She certainly makes it quite well. And in this way, not only one, but two points are made for those who are paying attention. About inclusion, yes, but also about the power and the wisdom of the supposed outsider, the foreigner, the enemy, the supposedly second class. You know, I don't know the answer to any of this story. I suppose we'll never know. But here's one thing that we do know for sure. She sure did hit that ball out of the park. And whether or not she opened Jesus' mind in the process, I'm confident that she opened more than one mind among his disciples that day, at least for a fleeting moment, before they fell back into the old fears and resentments and patriarchy that has named the church ever since. I'm even sure she'll open one or two of our minds here today if we're not careful. The virtuoso of faith that she is, a profile in courage. Do you have eyes to see, ears to hear? "Be opened," she said. "Be opened to new possibilities." There can be, in our world today, nationalism and pride concerning our country. In like stead, there can be pride in our faith family, Christianity for most of us here. But in neither case is there room for anything but humility in our most prideful moments. Because all nations and all faith groups have similar reasons to be proud. And I found myself hesitating to ponder if there ever is any room for pride in regard to being a person that's kind of white. Because white skin has only garnered pluses and accomplishments as a result of horrible racisms. I don't think there's any reason to feel pride when our group has stepped up by being on the backs of others. One last reflection that I had with our scripture this morning. I read it several times this week with a precondition. This woman is arguing for the saving of her daughter, and I am biased to believe what I have read before, Jesus saying, "Go, your faith has made her well." That's another story, by the way. I want you to read this story again because it says something absolutely, totally different. She tells him, and I quote, that even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And then Jesus announces to her, "Listen, for saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter," end quote. She goes home and finds that it's true. God heals no matter the woman's belief or unbelief. She does not have to believe in order for her daughter to be made well. She does not have to be Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist to be loved and valued by God. It's a phenomenal statement of God's universal caring for all humankind, regardless of nationality, faith, or family tree. What is it about this woman's reply to Jesus that makes a difference? Why does he end up affirming the healing and deliverance of her daughter? The story is marked, I think, by the woman's persistence. If it is true that Jesus came first for the children of Israel and then after that for the rest, the woman demonstrates that perseverance and protest can create a new paradigm. Syrophoenician or not, this woman's daughter is healed, delivered, and set free. I found that exploring this text wonderfully unsettling, and so is uncovering the wounds of racism and sexism in relation to how churches can too often be racist, sexist, patriarchal, non-changing. Perhaps the directness of the dialogue between Jesus and this unnamed Syrophoenician woman, maybe it reminds us to name the differences and call out the sins of the organizations that we are part of. In order to be delivered from these demons that hold our society hostage, we have to name things clearly. This is a significant step in the process toward full healing and restoration in this story. I don't know about you, but are you tired? Are you tired of the daily barrage of hammering home so many of the ugly realities in our society that we hear almost daily in our news? Well, so was this woman. And salvation came to her and her family. It seems because of her fighting, even when she was tired. Now is the time for us to be persistent. We can rest in death for having lived life well when it was most important. Today is very important. Be the woman, be the man that God is luring you to be. You and I do not have to save the world, but we can save a few moments that are ours to save and to make a significant difference that will add up with everyone else's. It is our job, no matter how tired and disgusted we may be, to be persistent.